Okay, so we now have some basic terminology for dealing with probabilistic outcomes. And so now I'd like to start discussing sort of where, how we can make use of these notions. So I'm going to start with discussing what's called discrete event simulation, and what we look at today is basically just how you would build a discrete event simulation model, and I've actually pushed most of the probabilistic elements to the subsequent two lectures. The first thing I want the people to understand is just exactly what these models are, and then we'll again take a deeper look at the probabilistic components of the models, and we'll use see how, based on sort of a few theoretical results, we can extract some useful information out of these models. So the reference for the simulation discussion is primarily Harry Peros, Computer Simulation Techniques, The Definitive Introduction. And it's you can get this as a PDF file from the link below. Okay. And this really does cover all the main topics you need to start building your own discrete event simulators. And if you want to go sort of into further depth, you can get textbooks on the subject of discrete event simulation, and Jerry Banks et al. Has a discrete event system simulation, which is fairly comprehensive. There's a lot of editions of this in the library, and for our purposes, they all cover pretty much the same topics. What changes from edition to edition tends to be sort of an update of examples, not the core theory. So, we're looking at simulation, a very specific sort of simulation called a discrete event simulation. So what is a simulation? Again, I pulled some definitions from Banks. A simulation is the imitation of the operation of a real-world process or system over time. Okay, and so essentially it's a model, and instead of having the actual system, you can have this model and interrogate then the model. So what's a simulation model? It's a set of assumptions concerning the operation of the system, and that allows us to then generate the behavior for the system. Now, again, lots of different ways of simulating systems exist, so the assumptions can take a lot of different forms, mathematical, logical, or symbolic, and we're interested in sort of a combination of mathematical and logical representations. So this gives us essentially a language or a model through which we can produce representations of system behavior, and by studying those representations arrive at some understanding of the system behavior. So So simulations are one possible form of testing that can help to study a system. And so again, we look at the behavior of the system and we can draw some conclusions about system performance. Essentially, our model is generating possible behaviors for the system. And so if there's an infinite number of possible behaviors, we can't look at them all. We can only generate some finite subset. So we're not going to get a complete picture of how the system acts in all possible conditions. What we'll see again in a later lecture is how do we generate sort of enough behaviors that they tell us something significant or something interesting about the system. There are alternative testing methods. You could actually build prototyping, means that you actually build the system or some sort of simplified version of the system. Again, it leads to the issue that you still can't look at all possible behaviors of the system. And possibly simulation would be a less expensive alternative to prototyping. We can also try for mathematical analysis, and indeed we'll look at that in this module. And the main tool for our purposes will be queuing theory. Okay. So, queuing theory allows, in some cases, for closed form solutions. So somehow you've represented, again, you've tied up all possible behavior into your mathematical representation. The drawback is that you often have to make simplifying assumptions in order to get that finite closed form solution. So it's possible that the models that you can produce analytically are not as realistic as you could produce either through prototyping or through simulation. Okay, so again, there's lots of different types of simulation. Essentially, all we're saying is that we are sort of abstractly representing our system and producing system behavior so that we can study it. We're looking at a specific type of simulation called a discrete event simulation. And what a discrete event simulation tries to do is, well, it essentially tries to track the state of the system, and it assumes that system state doesn't change continuously, but rather changes at discrete instants in time. And so an event denotes the change in a significant change in system state. So where randomness comes in is that we usually can't fully predict the instant at which the events occur, and yet the time of occurrence of those events is significant to us, so we are concerned with the time of occurrence of the events. So typically there is some probabilistic distribution describing the time of occurrence of these events. Usually one event is caused by something else happening in the system, and it's caused at some time in the future, and that time is not deterministic, but rather adheres to some probabilistic distribution. Okay. the output for our simulation. Again, we said we wanted to track the system behavior, how the system operates. So the output is a trace, and a trace is a sequence of events that represent the behavior of the system. So again, if you can track the changing of state, then you can, that sort of fully describes what's happening in the system. Okay, so terminology: an event denotes the change in state of the system. And so and a sequence of events denotes the evolution of the system state. Events may have timestamps, and the timestamp is a label that indicates the time of occurrence. Okay, so to take a very simple example, think of a light being switched on or off. Then the state of the system is the light is on or the light is off. The events in the system are that we switch on the light or we switch off the light. In order to fully model this system, we might want to, again, say something about the time of occurrence of these switching on and off the lights. And we will need to, again, represent that probabilistically. It could be completely random, or we could say, well, we know it's more likely to be turned on during working hours, or, you know, somehow we need to come up with some representation of that sort of time. Okay. What we typically sort of the states and events are related. For instance, if the light is on, well, the only possible next event is that the light is switched off, takes you to the off state. If the light is off, the only next event would be to switch on, take you to the on state. So our trace is our sequence of time-stamped events, and, you know, again, assuming that we can only switch on from the off state and off from the on state, then we can see our traces can consist of a sequence of on, off, a sequence of on, off, on, off, on, off. Okay. So we need to relate events and states. That will give us, again, sort of our rules for, relating events and states gives us our rules for the system. And so we can usually do this using a state machine. Okay, and that state machine is just going to represent the relation between events and states. It takes the form of a directed graph. And so the nodes are the states of the system, and the arcs are the events. And an event takes you from one state to another, so the arcs are directed from one state to another. Okay. The time distribution then will have to be added on separately. It can be possibly annotated onto the arcs. Okay. Time can be represented either between events or from state to state, so representing duration in a given state. Okay. The trace, again, it will give us an annotated, a time-stamped sequence of events, and again, it's in this case, cycle between on and off events. Okay, something we're going to see fairly often as we go through is a queue. And so the events are for a queue are you can either arrive or depart. And typically we take the state to be the number in the queue. And as for timing, well, we need to think about what we know. And typically we denote inter-arrival times. So what's the time between one arrival event and the next? And service times. So how long does it take a departure event to occur? So what's the time between one departure event and the next? And again, typically now we're going to describe our inter-arrival time and our service time as a some sort of probabilistic distribution. And as I mentioned in the last lecture, one of the most common assumptions for inter-arrival times will be that it has an exponential distribution. Okay, so those are the sort of, that's roughly what a discrete event simulation is going to look like and produce. And we can use this to study all sorts of things. Two sort of main categories would be that we could look at alternative design decisions. So we can compare the behavior of two designs to the same set of inputs. So we could have two different models and see how they behave. So we could, for instance, look at a token ring versus an Ethernet LAN. We could look at where a new base station should be deployed in a cellular network and see what impact the alternative locations would have on capacity. We can also look at existing systems and then ask the question, well, what's the impact of change on the existing systems? So for how will a network react to an increase in user demand? If we have a call center, when should we add a new worker? So what's the impact of adding more resources to the network? So to get an idea, so what you're going to do in your your first assignment is to code a simulation model. And so we'll see that there's a number of components to this model. And to get sort of a feel for what these components would be and how they'd work, we're going to start looking at an example. Okay, so again, this is taken directly from the Harry Paros notes. Okay. So, the problem is the machine repair problem, and so we have a collection of machines which occasionally break down, and we have a repairman, and the repairman repairs the machines on a first-come, first-served basis. Okay, so essentially we have a queue here where the repairman is the server, and so the repair time is down to the repairman. The arrival time for events is, how often do the machines break down? So We might want to know something about the performance of the system. So we could ask, what percentage of time is a machine down? Or for what percentage of time is the repairman busy? These are going to be functions of the time between breakdowns and the speed with which the repairs can be carried out. Okay. So we can think about how we're going to represent this as a discrete event simulation. And so the basic elements of our simulation model are state and events. And again, exactly how we represent those is going to depend on what sort of information are we going to need. So basically, the state is the status of the machines, or you could think of state as being the repair queue. But do we need to know the order of the machines in the repair queue? Is it enough to know just how many machines are in the queue? And that's going to somewhat depend on the question you want to answer. So if all you want to know is how often the repairman is busy, it's probably enough to know the general state of the queue. If you want to know something about the individual machines, well, you're going to have to track their individual states then. Events are machines break down and machines are repaired. Again, we may need to know which individual machine it is or not. Okay, so what else do we need? We need rules. We need to say how the states and events are related. And so we know that the arrivals and departures are going to change the state of the system. So change it, if we think of the system again as being our queue, who's in the queue depends on who's broken down and who's been repaired. The state of the system additionally has an impact on both arrivals and departures. We can see this fairly clearly for departures. If there's multiple machines in the queue, then who gets served is going to depend on some sort of service discipline. So are we serving, again, last in, first out, or first in, first out? So all of those rules need to be accounted for when we to get an accurate representation of the system. And ultimately, what the rules are. Okay. Yeah. So, obviously, time is important. The questions that we've asked, how frequently is the repairman busy? What's the time between repairs? Things like that. All are based on time. And so we're going to need to have some way of tracking time. So we have to have some rules, temporal rules, about when do the machines break down and how long do they take to fix. We can represent time using clocks, and so the clocks will be used to show the time of occurrence of an event. And we can also have a master clock, which keeps track of the system time overall. Okay, and so the master clock will timestamp our events. So we also have to have some initial condition. We have to assume an initial state somewhere where the simulation starts. If we look at our example, we can think of, you know, let's fix the quantities. We'll say we have three machines, each of which breaks down after 10 hours of use, and each takes 5 hours to repair. So we've given deterministic time numbers to time. We will need at least 4 clocks, 3 event clocks, which indicate the breakdowns and repairs, and a clock essentially associated with each machine, and 1 master clock to track the overall passage of time. We can get away with 3 clocks because for each machine, you'll either have a breakdown event or a repair event. You won't be looking at both in the same time frame. So the state is the state of the machines, possibly, or the state of the repair queue. We may or may not want to explicitly represent both of those. So what our simulation is going to do is, again, it's going to produce behavior. The form, our representation of behavior is going to be a trace. This represents one possible behavior that the system could exhibit amongst potentially an infinite number of possible behaviors. To get a single behavior, we obviously need some sort of starting point. So we give our model an initial state. Okay. And so in this case, and I've actually set it up slightly different than described. We have 3 events clock. The way I've set it up, we have an event clock indicating the machine breakdown, so 3 event clocks for the breakdowns and a single clock for a repair. Okay. So, just indicating again, depending on sort of how you're thinking of it at any given time, we can write the model differently. Okay, but in our example, okay, the 4 clocks are the machines plus the repair, and of course we have a master clock as well, giving us the overall time. So we start at time 0, but we have said when each of our machines is going to break down. And so the first change in the system is going to occur with the breakdown of machine 1, which is going to happen at time 1. Okay, so machine 1 has broken down at time 1. It's the first machine to have broken down, so we will be repairing it immediately. And it takes 5 seconds to repair, so if we're at time 1, 1 plus 5 gives us 6. The state of the system is, well, we have 1 machine in for repair, and we can possibly want to track or make a note that that's machine 1. And the status of the repairman is now busy. The next thing to happen is that machine 2 breaks down. And so that happens at time four, and we're still waiting to repair, we're still trying to repair the first machine, but we now have two machines in the queue. Then a machine gets repaired. So machine one gets repaired. That happens at time six. And we know, what do we know? We know that when a machine is repaired in 10 more time units, it will break down again. And since the queue is not empty, we know that in 5 more time units, we'll have repaired another machine. Okay, so in this case, we're going to repair machine 2. Going again. The next thing to happen is that machine 3 breaks down. And so we're still working to repair machine 2, so the repair time doesn't change. But our state changes. Okay. Then machine 2 is repaired. That means that it'll break down in another, that's at time 11, it'll break down in another 10 time units. There's still machine 3 in the queue, so we know we'll fix it in another 5 time units. The state of the queue is machine 3 is the only machine waiting. And we see now we have two events which are going to occur at the same time. And so you have to make some decision about which one you're going to deal with next. Potentially, in most cases, it won't make a difference. Possibly in some cases it might. In this case, it really wouldn't make a difference which order you dealt with those events in. Okay. So again, what we saw is just by hand, what we've done is we've run through the behavior of the system, and we have gotten event occurrences, and we've seen the times of occurrence of those events. And so that sequence of events plus the sequence of event time-stamped events gives us our behavior for the system, so that's our event trace. Exactly what behavior is exhibited, in this case, is going to depend on initial conditions. Typically, in most cases, is going to depend on the randomness, the random time assignments of the system, which essentially for simulation are in some way based on the initial conditions, but in a way that's not what we'll see, is in a way that's not easy to predict. Even for this simple system, we will have an infinite number of behaviors based on how we set up the system. Possibly they're all going to have some sort of similarity, and that's sort of what we are going to try and pull out. So the big question for these sorts of simulations is how to extract information from one or more traces, and typically, always we'd use more than one trace, or typically we'd use more than one trace. And how do we extrapolate from the looking at some behavior of the system to being able to make a conclusion about all behavior of the system. Okay, and so we'll go over that later. Okay, so again, randomness is going to sort of increase the sort of types of behavior we can see, but again, by making some assumptions about the randomness and the statistical nature of the system, we're going to be able to answer that question about generalizing from a sequence of traces to all behavior. Okay, so we are representing the system in a very specific way in this discrete event way. So we're assuming that again, what we care about in the system stays constant in between events. In the example, we saw the components that we're going to need to build a discrete event simulator. And these are the components that you are going to need to code when you program your simulator. Okay, so we have events which signify the change of state. We have clocks to track the time of occurrence of events. And we may also have a master clock to keep track of time elapsing in this sort of globally in the system. State represents the state of the system. That can be the state of the queue. In our example, we could say it was either the state of the queue or just whether the repairman was busy or idle. What exactly is the state, again, is going to depend on what we want to represent within our system. Events will cause change to the state, and the state in turn restricts what events can possibly occur while in that state. So, for instance, if you're idle, you can't have a repair event. So, we need to define the relationship between state and events with a set of rules. And so what the simulator is going to do is it's going to examine the events as they occur and determine how the event changes the state of the system. And we're going to describe that state change by deciding what events will be caused by the occurrence of our current event. Okay, so so the state of the system is given. We say that the state of the system then is related to the state of the event queue, or is related to the event queue. And we use that to decide how the model evolves. Okay. Within discrete event simulations, there are three different approaches to building the simulation model. We'll be using the first, which is called Event Advance. Two others that we'll briefly describe our unit time advance and activity based. Event advance models move from event occurrence to event occurrence to event occurrence. So the simulator will produce a time-ordered future event list, and the master clock is advanced to the time of occurrence of the next event. The event list is then updated, so the current event is removed and new events are scheduled as a consequence of the current event. So, again, the key is that you're moving from event to event to event. Another possibility is to evolve according to time. And here we move forward according to the change in the master clock. And so the master clock advances one unit at a time. And then we compare the event clocks with the master clock value. And if the values are equal, the event occurs and the appropriate actions are taken. Okay, so again, the difference is that now the movement occurs on the clock. So this can be useful if events happen at times that are close to one another, or if events happen at regular intervals. Okay. So the final method is activity-based. And so here, instead of focusing on events, the basic element of the simulator is an activity. And each activity has duration. So it's more equivalent to states than events. The simulator will then describe the conditions by which activities stop and start. Okay. So if we look at our queue, well, in advance simulation, we would be jumping from arrivals. We would sort of trace out a sequence of arrivals and departures. Now we have to think about having activities. And so we can think about having three activities: inter-arriving, so the process of arriving. So there's a certain time associated with between one arrival and the next. And so we denote those by the ATIs. Waiting, so a process may have to wait before getting service, so in the queue. And then a process, a job gets service. So we have these sort of overlapping collections of events. And so we can see, we can trace, so for job I, we can trace between its arriving to its waiting to its being served. And that, the next process and the next process would again have this sequence of arriving, waiting, being served. Okay, and this can be useful in comparing if you have sort of job service. Okay. And so we're again going to be concerned with event-based simulation. And so the major components of an event-based simulation model are the events with their clocks and the system state. And underpinning all of that, of course, the rules by which you link events and states are the core of the simulator will be the event list. And so this is a list of scheduled events, so events that are due to occur. And we assume that they are time ordered. We make that assumption because then it makes it easy to process the list. We examine it an event at a time, starting with the sort of next up to occur. The event logic describes what happens to the system when an event occurs. So we pull, again, the first event off the event list. We examine it. Take into account what we know of the system, the state, whatever sort of representation we've made of the system state. And based on that, we schedule new events and update our system state. And we will also need some way of handling our time within the system. So we'll need to update our clocks as the as time advances. So again, as we pull an event off and it off the event list, we know the current time. Okay. What, again, we're not going to discuss in this lecture exactly how we represent time probabilistically. So what's the output? The output is the sequence of events as they're pulled off the event list. Okay, so graphically, this is what happens. We have, again, the core of our system is this future event list. We pull off if it's time ordered, we pull off the first up event. We advance our time to the time of that event. And then we have to take action based on the event. And action consists of updating the state of our system potentially so that we know we can keep track of what rules we need, and scheduling of events. Okay. And so if new events can now occur, we have to add them again in a time-ordered fashion to our event list. It's possible that events could also cause events to be descheduled. So if something happens, then something else doesn't happen. And that's not a huge step further. In our case, we're going to assume that we're only adding events. So the event list is a list of events ordered according to time of occurrence. And so one question that arises is, what sort of data structure do I need to contain that list? Okay, And we can start by thinking about, well, what are we going to have to do to that list? And so we remove events from the top of, if the list is ordered, we need to remove first events. If we can deschedule events, then we possibly need to remove events from other positions in the list. And when we create events, we need to add them in a time sequenced fashion to the list. Okay, so lists can be of an arbitrary length, which makes storage potentially problematic. So we're going to have to potentially give the storage to the list on the fly. One of the most common data structures for holding an arbitrary length ordered list is the what's called the linked list. Okay. So the good news for you, particularly if you code your assignment in Java. Java actually has classes for linked lists, and so you really don't need to worry too much about how it works, but we'll go over the basic idea anyway. So a linked list is a way of implementing a list structure without having items physically in order or even grouped together. Okay, and usually this is contrasted with a list where physical position is important. So say we had our list contained in a vector. And so each entry to the vector was in order. So in our example, we're trying to create a list of alphabetical order. Okay, so vectors are a bit problematic in that it's very difficult to add elements to the middle of the list. So in this case, if we wanted to add Jane to the list, we'd have to add her between Fred and Tim. Tim would have to move down, and then Jane would have to be written down. If there were 50 entries after Tim, they'd all have to be moved down by one. Also, vectors are of a fixed length specified when you initialize the vector, and so you can't add an arbitrary amount of information to your list. So what we'd like to do is, well, first of all, get rid of this idea that ordering is connected to the physical location of your data. Okay. So here we've gotten rid of physical location. We just have a bunch of names on the page. But that's not quite going to do it for us, because we now don't have any way of knowing that they're related at all. So we're going to have to indicate some relation between the names. And we do this using what are called pointers. And for us, we can think of them as just being a pointer gives you the location of the information. So we have a list head, a start point, and it points to the first item in the list. The first item in the list, has to point to the second item in the list, which then points to the third item and the fourth. Okay. So, the information, we have to store two components of information. We store our data, and we also have to store this pointer, which is the location of the next piece of data. Okay, so in this way, we can put our data anywhere we want, as long as we then link it into the list with these pointers. So this frees us from sort of a position-dependent representation of order within the list, and it's also good because we can dynamically allocate space for the components. So each time we add a new component, we just request the space on the fly, and then rearrange the pointers to link the data to the existing list. Okay, so what do we mean by rearranging pointers? Well, again, if we think of our linked list, you've got your list head, and then you've got a sequence of data structures which contain the data plus the pointer to the next item. And so if we want to add information, we just have to break, you know, we need to decide where that information goes, and we break the link between the two datas where you want the two components where you want to insert the data, and you change the first component to point to the new data, and the new data to point to the second component. Okay. And similarly, if you want to delete data, then it's just a matter of changing the value of the pointers. If you remove data, well, then you should also deallocate the space for that data. So that's, you know, straightforward enough. One awkward thing about linked lists is that you have to, if you want to look through the list, if you want to search the list, the only way to do it is to go from start to finish. You have to search the components in the list in order. So in our case in particular, if we're arranging in terms of time, well, you have to search through and find the two nodes where you're in between the time of occurrence of those nodes. And so that can get to be that can take time. Okay, so again, the good news for you is that you don't actually have to write your own linked list. Java.util has a linked list class, and so the class uses a list iterator to keep track of the position of the position that you are currently at within the list, and you can insert and delete and search relative to that iterator. Okay, so it's not terribly hard to use the linked lists within Java. Okay, and C will have libraries somewhere that have already written linked lists for you. Okay, so again, my suggestion would be for your assignment that you're not doing anything too terribly complicated, so a linked list is fine. Searching, as we noted, searching the linked list can be problematic since you can potentially have to search the entire list. There are other structures possible that will allow for faster sorts, and so Peros again will discusses for instance the heap structure, which again is more efficient for searching for what you're doing. That the linked list ought to be fine. Okay, so the event logic again is how you decide what events to schedule at any given time. And so it's got to be a combination of the current event and some representation of the state of the system. Now, in theory, the system state is actually contained in the event list, but in practice you may want to sort of represent the state or track state separately in a way that makes your decisions more straightforward than having to potentially examine the entire event list to decide what you're doing. Okay, and so as we saw before, what state you choose can depend on exactly what sort of questions you're asking. So is it sufficient to know for instance, the number of machines in for repair, or do you have to know the ordering of the machines in for repair? So those are things you have to think about when you're developing the logic for the simulation. And you can also sort of again decide when to schedule events. As an example, when a machine breaks down, do you immediately schedule the repair? That's probably going to require you to sort of again examine the event list and see if there are other machines waiting for repair, or do you defer the scheduling of the repair event until there's only one machine left? And if so, can you track? If so, you still need to track sort of potentially which machine it is. Okay, so the bottom line is there's usually multiple ways of representing the system and the state, and you want to try and be as sort of as simple, you want it to be as simple as possible while still capturing the relevant information. Okay, so we have our repairman problem, and the question I asked was, how do we determine the time of events? And so again, this is getting at when should we potentially schedule the events. So we start out with our initial list of breakdowns. And based on the first breakdown, we schedule a repair. Now, when we have a second breakdown, the way we handled that was we left scheduling the second repair until the first repair was completed, and that's fine. Or we could schedule the second repair immediately, but we would need to examine the list to determine exactly what time that repair could take place at. If if we were to schedule the repair, then, you know, again, state would be fairly simple. It's just, you know, the sequence of events. But by tracking state externally, so by tracking which machine or what machines need service, we can, again, schedule the repairs sort of as they enter service. Okay, so what you do is, again, you can take many different approaches to describing the same sort of sequence of events. So the final component that is sort of critical is time, and determining the timestamp for the events. And so far we've looked at deterministic times for events, but usually this is not what we have. So we have probabilistic times, and our example with queues, we had inter-arrival times and service times, and those usually had some probabilistic distribution. Okay, so we will look in an upcoming lecture at how we can build these probabilistic or sequences of numbers that adhere to these probabilistic distributions. But usually, most high-level programming languages provide some facility for generating these numbers. Okay. And so we have, for instance, uniform distributions. In Java, the random class can be used to generate pseudo-random numbers, so numbers that look random and adhere to a uniform distribution. And what, again, for queues, we're frequently looking at exponential distributions. That's not explicitly included, But we'll see that it's quite easy to extract these explicit, but to extract an exponential distribution once we're given a uniform distribution. So again, we'll look at that when we consider we'll consider these this in more depth later. Okay, so what do we have? We've looked at sort of, again, just trying to get an idea of what exactly a discrete event simulation is. It gives us sort of one way of studying system behavior, so we generate sample representations of behavior in the form of these event traces. And the main components are the event lists, the event logic, and the clocks. And yeah, the whole trick is sort of describing them in an appropriate fashion. Okay. So since time, again, is usually random, we're going to have to look at how to generate random variables. From a practical point of view, it's going to be straightforward. We can use sort of the facilities provided by the language. Okay, but from a theoretical point of view, we'll look at exactly how we can generate these sorts of numbers and sort of how we can convince ourselves that they actually are random in a satisfactory fashion. So we'll look at, following on from this, we'll look at two components. We'll look at this idea of random number generation and what we call random variate generation, so sequences adhering to different distributions, and we'll look at how to create them and then how to convince ourselves that they actually do look sufficiently random. And then we'll also look at the system outputs, and again, mathematically, how can we draw conclusions from the system outputs? And so but we'll do that in the next two lectures.